All right, it's just a couple minutes after 10 o'clock. You're tuned to WPKN. That's at 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut. It's the first Sunday of the month, and it's time for Ken McDermott Rowe's In Context. They've got their bulletproof Kevlar suits on. They're ready. Ken and Gus are ready to go, along with their co-conspirator, March. Go ahead, Ken.
Thank you so much, Dave. This is Ken McDermott Rowe. I'm here with my fellow host, Gus Cantavero.
Hey, everybody. Glad to be back.
Welcome to In Context, where we take a look at some of the important news that you may have missed, that may have been missed by the corporate media, and give you some unique interpretations of that news. We'll be taking call-ins tonight, as usual, and we'll be giving out our phone number, and we'll also be giving out our email address a little shortly.
Why don't we go ahead and give that now?
Okay. The call-in number is 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756. And if you would like to email us, you can email us at ken@mdrtalk.org. That's ken@mdrtalk.org. So please, during the show, send us an email or give us a ring. Tonight, we're very happy on In Context to introduce a new monthly feature, which we call The War Report. In this feature, we'll examine recent developments in the global wars and discuss these developments' political and strategic implications. And we'll be joined in these monthly discussions by In Context military affairs commentator March McDermott Rowe.
Good evening.
And we'd also like to announce, we're very happy to announce, a new schedule for In Context. We'll be on more often and for longer. Under the new schedule goes at WPKN, which goes into effect this month, In Context will be on the second and fourth Mondays of every month from noon and 1 p.m. So we'll be on for a full hour taking your calls rather than the half-hour shows that we've had in the past. No more Wednesday nights.
By popular demand.
By popular demand. So the second and fourth Mondays from noon to 1 p.m. And we'll continue through the generosity of Dave Schwartz to be on Sunday nights at 10 p.m. where we bring you the In Context War Report. So let's get started with the recent news that it's been very important that after several months of fighting, the Libyan government has been overthrown by the U.S. NATO-backed coalition. And, March, I'd like your thoughts on how important was the U.S. NATO military support in achieving the rebel victory, and how is this rebel victory going to change the political situation in the region?
Well, I mean, I think that, first of all, it's a little much to say it's a victory as of yet. We still haven't captured, well, when I say we, the rebels haven't captured, although there's a fine line, the rebels haven't yet captured Gaddafi, and a lot of his loyalists are holding out, which does suggest there is an element of popular support for him in spite of everything. It's actually very well known and not much denied, in fact, widely acknowledged by members of the U.S. government and the British government that Libyan troops on the ground have been led by members of U.S. Army Special Forces and the British Special Air Service, also known as the SAS.
Right, right, right.
And that was actually reported by an eyewitness to the attack in Tripoli, Terry Mason, who's wrote an article, a dispatch. Practically the day he wrote, he witnessed it. It was produced on August 21st in Global Research, and he said that there were NATO officers leading the attack on Tripoli.
Well, and actually, this is precisely what special forces train to do. A common misconception that people have is that special forces is a cover-all word people use for the Navy SEALs, Marine Force Recon, et cetera, Air Force Special Operations. But the actual special forces, also known as the Green Berets, U.S. Army Special Forces, this is the bread and butter of what they train to do. Unlike the Navy SEALs, whose job it is basically they are, for lack of a better term, meatheads, as they're commonly called. They're professional killers. Their job is to go in and find people that are, you know, Taliban leaders, Al-Qaeda leaders, people we don't like, and go in and assassinate them. Mm-hmm. The Green Berets, on the other hand, their main mission is to go behind enemy lines and train rebels or insurgents against people we don't like. Whether acknowledged or unacknowledged, and we've done
something
this.
The CIA has kind of taken under their wing. Haven't they done that predominantly over the past 50 years?
Oh, yes.
I mean, weren't they the ones that went to Cuba to train the insurgents there during the Bay of Pigs? All that sort of stuff?
Precisely. Special forces often operate under the CIA's cover.
Oh, okay. So under their leadership, they'll instruct who to go and train, and then the Green Berets will go in and actually do the job.
Precisely.
Okay.
This is the bread and butter of what they do, is take an indigenous army. And this was really forged during Vietnam. And again, this is something widely acknowledged. I mean, there are books written about it, namely a very popular book called War Stories of the Green Berets, which talks about how the Green Berets' trial by fire, if you will, was during the Vietnam War when they went into parts of South Vietnam and trained Montagnards, the indigenous people of South Vietnam, and formed them into militias and armies to fight against the Viet Cong and the NVA, and this was immensely successful. So this stayed in operation up until the present day. These men also trained with the Northern Alliance against the Taliban in 2001. They trained with the Kurdish Peshmerga, which is also interesting because these are the same people who are waging a war against Iran and Turkey, coincidentally, but not fighting U.S. forces in Iraq. So that has leads you to wonder about our continued ties to the Peshmerga, also known as the PKK.
Well, in the beginning of this rebellion in Libya, Gaddafi accused the NATO of working with al-Qaeda, and he was largely ridiculed for making that accusation. But then it's subsequently reported in the New York Times. This is September 1st, that the head of the military in Tripoli under the rebel government is a fellow named Abdel Hakim Balhaf, who was an emir for the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, and a group which was identified by the United States as affiliated with al-Qaeda.
Al-Qaeda is often used as a sort of coverall word by the United States and by most Western powers and even by other Middle Eastern powers for people they don't like. I mean, the same way
we'll say, that's mainly because Westerners are not sophisticated to know the difference between them.
This man, Balhaf, had been kidnapped at the behest of the United States in 2004. Well, and part of what they call extraordinary rendition program. But apparently now he's in our good graces and was working with us in this in rebellion.
Well, like I say, you know, al-Qaeda is a coverall word. And now that nominally that particular group is no longer affiliated, technically speaking, with al-Qaeda, they renounced their affiliations to the best of my knowledge. And, you know, again, when you renounce your affiliations, does that mean you entirely renounce the ideology? No, it's just it means that they're no longer an ally of convenience. We're the greater ally of convenience right now.
We come back to there's a lot of hypocrisy, of course, about all of our invasions. And in the case of Libya, it was because Gaddafi had become a despot and we invaded to protect the civilians. But if we take a look at history, we see that Gaddafi came to power in rebellion in 1969, in which he overthrew a government that was really in the pocket of the United States and Britain. And one of the first things he did was to close down the American and the British military bases in the country.
Libya was also torn apart by tribalism as well. It was a really divisive region. North Africa had absolutely no organization to it, and it took someone who, with an iron fist like Gaddafi, to organize it and actually give it some rule of law.
And he
as we've seen, what happened as soon as he's taken out, what happens? The racists in these extremist organizations start going around rounding up the black Africans and beheading them. You know, the BBC is driving around and they're showing images of people who are shot in the back of the head with their hands tied.
Yeah.
And they're saying, well, this looks like some rebels here who were assassinated by Gaddafi loyalists. And if anyone who really knows what they're looking at knows that these were just average regular guys who are walking around who are loyal to Gaddafi because they actually had some protection under his iron fist.
Right.
And they were killed because they are not of Arab descent.
Right.
They're not, they're not extremists like they are. They don't agree with them. So
what we're finding is a new faction that we can work with that will realign the country away from Russia.
Well, we love religious extremists.
I think it's not so much a matter of any particular group that we can work with. I mean, Gaddafi was originally brought into power because he received immense support from Gamal Abdel Nasser, who was the socialist. Well, nominally he was a nationalist and later on became a socialist after Kennedy was assassinated and we cut ties with Egypt. The nominally socialist leader of Egypt who helped bring Gaddafi to power. And Gaddafi went through his sways of being a pan-Arabist and then a pan-Islamist and then a pan-Africanist. And one of the problems is that he received an immense amount of support from sub-Saharan African nations who he helped sponsor. Ironically, you know, as much of a despot as we depict him to be, and as much of a despot as he probably was, he helped fund a lot of, you know, relatively good economic projects in some of these sub-Saharan African countries. So you had a lot of sub-Saharan Africans coming up to fight for Gaddafi.
Yeah.
So then the rebels see this, and then they use it as an excuse to ethnically cleanse Libya. And Libya being very tribal to begin with, it breaks down a civil war. And that's precisely what that, any invading
and notice
Western
what
power
NATO
wants.
Bombs first. You know, they go right for the eyes, basically. They bombed the pipe fitting factory, which is makes the largest metal pipes in the world.
Is that
and
right?
They built the only the largest man-made canal to bring fresh water from the desert into Libya to give fresh water to millions of people.
This is a huge
so
public
so not only did they bomb this gigantic trench of water to prevent fresh water from coming in, but they also bombed the pipe fitting factory that built the pipes. So there's no way that the Libyans can repair this water without NATO's help.
Is that right?
So they're showing images of showing how the people don't have food and water in Tripoli.
Because,
and oh my gosh, what a horrible thing. This is because Gaddafi had the balls to stick it out, and it's his fault.
Right.
We're the ones who bombed it.
Of course, of course. But you're getting to also why we were annoyed at Gaddafi is because he had the sovereign wealth fund, and he was funding all these huge projects in Africa without the use of Western banks. And he was also had proposed creating a new currency in Africa, which would have been gold-backed, mm-hmm. which would have been a real threat to the supremacy
yeah,
of the dollar.
Yeah. And by the way, if you want to get in touch with us, the email address is ken@mdrtalk.org. And the phone number is 203-336-9756.
Well, and I think right now, I mean, again, there's no way kind of Gaddafi still was a tyrant, a despot who committed horrible crimes and invaded Egypt multiple times and failed attempts to topple Sadat and then topple Mubarak.
Uh-huh.
But in the same hand, I mean, right now, chaos is something. He did bring stability.
Yeah.
There was an Egyptian man who once said to me that the only way to have peace in regions of the Middle East like Iraq and Libya is to have a dictator with an iron fist. Otherwise, they're bound to kill each other. But that's something that works out very conveniently for the West, because instead of placing a million-man force or even a half a million man force of European and American troops on the ground, you get them to kill each other. They'll never be strong again. They'll never.
Well, no, look what's going to happen now. In the absence of Gaddafi, this country is going to be torn apart in civil war. They're just going to have constant bickering and tribal militias going back and forth, just like it was
the
before.
The Balkanization of these countries like Iraq and Libya fits right into the expansionary yeah. plans of the West.
And you know what? If people want to get behind this civilian defense, you know, that NATO is pretending to put forward, which it's not, because they killed more civilians than Gaddafi ever did just in this past couple months. They should just try to build up the region so that the people get sick of being under the fist of a dictator and they have their own popular revolution, I guess, in the way that Egypt did. Let them just have the standard of living come up so that they're able to speak for themselves. You know, don't try to overthrow someone and throw in another theocracy that is just going to keep people under the thumb. There's
right.
no way that
but,
this is an improvement.
But looking at it from our point of view, the point of view of the imperialist nation,
yeah.
you want a government in that you can deal with. If that's an autocrat, fine. And that's why we're so disingenuous. We really don't want democracy. We want a compliant government. If it happens to have a democratic facade, fine. If it's a theocracy, fine. If they're militants, we don't care, as long as they play ball with us economically.
No, but it's just offensive access. that they put the face on it, that it's a
they have
an intervention for humanitarian reasons. No, it's not.
They have a lot of nerve to put it politely. The WikiLeaks released documents recently that showed that in 2009, high American officials were meeting with Gaddafi's family, including Senator McCain and Connecticut's own Joe Lieberman.
Uh-huh.
And in these cables, which were released by WikiLeaks, Senator Lieberman went on to describe Libya as, quote, an important ally in the war on terrorism. This is just 2 years ago.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So we had this really close relationship that we're trying to foster. But then it turns out they were still cozying up to Russia. And they were not producing the oil contracts that we'd hoped.
Well, it is a very hypocritical setup, but there's nothing new in history. How many times Adolf Hitler was Time Magazine's Man of the Year, and people knew about Kristallnacht at the time. They knew about the persecution of Jews, the murdering of mentally disabled individuals, the murdering of the elderly and the invalids. And, you know, and still he was Time Magazine's Man of the Year.
Mm-hmm.
One thing people often forget is politicians do whatever is politically expedient. Politicians, for the most part, are entirely amoral. They will back a despot as easily as they will a Democrat if they feel it will get them reelected.
That's right. That's right.
Well, I mean, most of the wealthy elite are men without political allegiance. They don't answer to a flag. They answer to whoever has the most money to offer.
And we see in the United States that the wealthy people,
they'll invest in any country. It doesn't matter that they're Americans. They don't care because they answer to no country. They're men without countries, allegiances.
They're just chasing short-term profit. And they invest in political candidates, regardless of party, too.
Exactly.
They get money to Obama like they give them to McCain.
As Mark said, whatever's politically expedient. Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter what where you're from or what you look like. As long as you can serve their interest, they'll back you.
And in all these cables, according to the article I was reading in Global Research, there was no mention of concern about human rights violation in Libya.
Wasn't there also a mention about the CIA's cozy relationship with Libya and how they were supporting rendition? Extraordinary
right.
rendition,
that's
how they
right.
were sending them to these black sites on black flights.
That's right.
A lot
they
of black stuff.
They were cooperating with rendition.
And because it's illegal for the CIA to torture people, they just send it to Libya so that they can torture them for them. And then just if they happen to get information, then maybe they would just tell them.
That's right.
It's just so convenient. I mean, and this stuff is so thinly veiled. You know, even my son was watching BBC with me, and he said, "Wow, how come they mention the stuff that the WikiLeaks cables here? Because Britain is mentioned in them because they say they're reporting on themselves. This is interesting because they're saying Western intelligence agencies." And he says, "But BBC doesn't usually report on themselves." And I said, "Don't worry, they'll mention MI6, but they'll just focus on the CIA." And that's exactly what happened. They said that the CIA was involved. They shared some emails, but it was mostly the CIA sending people that they had captured to Libya to be tortured. So all these intelligence agencies just try to put the blame on each other.
That's right.
I'm sure MI6 had just as much to do with it as the CIA did. But the BBC, in order to maintain its credibility, is going to mention MI6, but they're not going to make it seem like they did anything extraordinarily bad. They're just going to make it seem like the CIA was driving and that the MI6 was just drowned down with them.
It's mental misdirection. I mean, it's the same thing we do when it comes to Iraq and Iran, for example. It's redirecting attention. It's saying, look at what, great democracy we've created in Iraq. Never mind the fact that all of our quote unquote allies there are supporters of Iran, are backed by Iran, and that Iran's threatening to invade its neighbors. Never mind that. It's all mental misdirection.
Speaking of Iran, March, the Iranians are engaging in certain naval activities in the Red Sea, which are very provocative. Could you talk about that?
Before you mention that, I just want to get the email again. Ken@mdrtalk.org if you want to get your comments mentioned on the air.
And our phone number is 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756.
But be quick. We only got about 10 more minutes. So go ahead.
Iran's ramping up its war rhetoric right now, and it's moving its military into position because it knows the United States is very, very, very reluctant right now because we are so woefully overstretched. We are very reluctant to get involved in a war. However, at this stage, Israel is very, very easily provoked.
What is Iran doing with its fleet?
Right now, I think what it's doing is it's putting its fleet within a striking position to strike at foreign forces.
It's going to be it's looking to control the Red Sea, the Gulf of Aden,
which is a strategic shipping route. And to be honest, I mean, our navy is immensely overstretched. The Israelis lack much of a navy to begin with, and so I mean, it's something to provoke us to say, hey, we're stepping in on your turf. I mean, Iran actually sent its foreign minister, if I'm not mistaken, to Somalia, which is a country we've had vast interest in for a very long time. So I think Iran is positioning itself to take over the hegemony of the Middle East as soon as Israel attacks Iran, which I'm convinced will be before Palestine goes to the vote.
And that's something we talked about in our last show.
And you think Israel will be the aggressor?
I think so. At this stage,
especially given the fact that they just had all these protests because the disaffected youth in Israel are very unhappy with the path of the country's current trajectory, does that mean that unifying that youth under the common cause of a war would be the answer out of this problem?
Precisely. It would also mean, because one thing that Israel has, which is very unique in the world, is it has conscription, which is not so unique. But what is unique is everyone in Israel, every male, remains a reservist for a good portion of their lives, I believe up into their 40s. So this means that if a major war breaks out, everyone gets called up. So all these protesters now are thrown into uniform and thrown into battle. But I think a very important part is that they see U.S. power in the Middle East waning. They see that they're themselves getting hemmed in by an Iran that is militarily strong, backed up by China and Russia, with the latest in military technology, with both China and Russia possess. And then they see an Iraq inherently allied with Iran. They see a Syria backed by Iran. They see a compliant in Egypt that's complying with Iran. So they see that Palestine's going for statehood.
Yes, well, that's really a key background fact that has only recently emerged in the corporate media. You could talk about that, Palestine's desire to go to the UN for a resolution for statehood.
The Palestinians, and I've known many Palestinians in my life, they, you know, it's hard to relate to, but being a people without a recognized homeland is, it's a crime. I mean, they lived there, they've always lived there, regardless of love or hate Israel. It's a fact, face up to it, world. And Palestinians want recognition.
And they're seeking it when the General Assembly opens its next session on September the 20th, which is what really I think was what's driving all of these, this escalation and tensions in the Middle East. And Turkey, it also has gotten into the fray, right, within its relations with Israel.
Precisely. But Turkey's issue relates to the fact that Israel, the Israeli methods for taking down the flotilla going to Gaza was immensely heavy-handed. They went on board and they boarded a ship under the Turkish flag. They killed passengers. I mean, it was clearly, hey, you want to stop a ship. You know what the Coast Guard does? I don't see the U.S. Coast Guard going in and shooting Colombians that are trying to cross over the waters or Haitians. I mean, I'm sorry. This doesn't happen anywhere else in the world.
So what has Turkey done in response?
They've expelled the Israeli envoy to Ankara. Mm. And in fact, they've demanded an apology from Israel. Israel has not apologized. And
I think they said they won't apologize.
They won't. They've actually openly refused to apologize.
Yeah, not just that. Well, we'll think about it.
And Turkey has not only the largest Middle East – and I mean, I'm sorry, the largest military in the Middle East, but they have the second largest military and advanced military in NATO, second only to the United States.
Hmm.
So this is a very dangerous enemy for Israel to have. And that's why I think Israel is going to launch a preemptive strike, because they see themselves getting hemmed in. And they're on what Sun Tzu would call death ground.
You've never seen a country that size, surrounded by that many enemies, be so arrogant and survive.
Well, exactly.
I mean, isn't that kind of like the shortest guy going into the most dangerous part of town?
Well, they've had a big,
and just like kicking everybody in the shins.
Well, they've had a protector, the United States.
That's what I'm getting at. Yeah.
And I guess the question is, and maybe it'll be resolved militarily in September with an attack, or maybe not resolved, but maybe they'll be attacked by Israel and Iran. I think this UN vote is going to be critical. If it even happens, it'll be a diplomatic disaster for the United States.
I think it's never going to even – I mean, if Israel is going to strike, they have to strike before the UN vote. I mean, they've been ramping up the building of the settlements. There's no way once it goes to a vote, even if the U.S. vetoes it, that Israel can get away with continuing to build or leaving the settlements there. The attack will have to be beforehand. And it's also important that it happens before we enter the election season in the U.S. because what's going to happen is the U.S. is by treaty obligated to defend Israel. So, and if Israel goes to war with that many enemies, it's going to need our help. There's no question about it. So the U.S. is going to have to commit upwards of, I mean, honestly, 500,000 men.
Here in America, I find it very startling how many people blindly support Israel without really understanding why we do. They just say that they're our biggest ally.
Right.
But nobody who understands geopolitics can say why they're our biggest ally, because most people logically would say Canada would be our biggest ally because they border us to the north and they protect us from Russia going over the North Pole or China. They share our waters. You know, that's actually a strategic ally. They have a lot of resources that we can mutually find beneficial: oil, timber, rock, all that kind of stuff.
Well, what is Israel?
What is Israel actually? Olives? I mean,
Israel is our permanent advanced base in a critical.
That's what it is. Yeah,
that's what it's
colonialism.
It's what it is essentially in America.
Not defense
colony
of our borders. You know. It's not like if we were attacked, they'd run over here.
And essentially, in American politics, Israel's interests have become conflated with the interests of the United States. But I think for the average, in terms of the view of the people or the interests of the people of the United States, that isn't a necessary conclusion. It's a different country. It has different interests, and we should pursue our interests.
Now, so what would the borders, if Palestinians recognize a statehood, what would their borders actually look like? Would it be the West Bank and Gaza Strip or something like that? In order to get from one or the other, you have to go through Israel.
Well, it's a 67 border, so.
Does that mean that they're
connected? The West Bank, but I think Gaza would continue to be disconnected from the West
Bank. So how could you have a country that's disconnected and you have to pass through checkpoints to get to it?
Technically speaking, as far as I know, when a Palestinian statehood is recognized, it's going to be recognized in the government of the Palestinian Authority, which, while they have a peace treaty with Hamas, is not recognized as the same government. So Gaza might not be recognized.
So when say Ireland or
– So it would just be the West Bank?
When these other European countries recognize – and something like more than 100 countries have recognized the Palestinian state. Do they recognize just the West Bank? Do they not? Do they exclude Gaza? What do they recognize?
I think Gaza would be included, but the government in Gaza is not recognized, I'm pretty sure. However, certain organizations like Sinn Féin in Ireland, and actually, believe it or not, the Russian government recognized Hamas because, let's face it, you know, they were democratically elected. I mean, one thing that's very hypocritical is we say, we love democracy, we support democracy, but only if you elect the people we like.
Well, yeah, okay. So Hamas was democratically elected, but if Hamas was able to get statehood passed and recognized, perhaps the people would say, okay, maybe unifying would be more beneficial to all of us.
The problem is we may make the Western world might make the caveat that we're going to give you statehood state recognition.
Caveat.
The caveat. Yeah, that one. You know. Yeah, not the fish eggs, you know, but – be that as it may, the catch, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. It would be the fact that Hamas is a quote-unquote terrorist organization. Now, we support people like the Peshmerga, who everybody else called terrorists. So, you know, it's a fine line. But
if you'd like to join the conversation, excuse me, March, you can give us a ring at 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756. Or drop us a question or comment by email to ken@mdrtalk.org.
You know, it's also been proven many times that Hamas was founded by the Mossad, you know, as a controlled opposition because they wanted the ability to crack down whenever they felt like it was.
Well, that's the ultimate power to pick your adversary's leadership.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's just the same as we created Al Qaeda. You know, yeah. They created the Hamas.
That's right.
But it becomes dangerous though when they go out of control. And I think that was one of the problems. Was I don't think anybody expected them to actually take over Gaza. Well, I think the idea was originally to split.
Let's
the
just give them some guns and bombs, right, and you right, know, right, we'll just play act.
Right.
Exactly. I think the original plan was to split the Palestinian Authority.
Marcia, I can ask you a question relating to some of the other countries in the region. What would happen to the monarchies in the event of a big war, like Saudi Arabia in particular?
Well, I think one of the goals of Iran is to eventually take control of Mecca and Medina and, by extension, Saudi Arabia and overthrow the monarchy there. I mean, to be honest, the Saudi monarchy in the event of a war is not long for this world, not because of popular unrest, but because they have a very tiny army that really – there are very few powers in the Middle East right now that could stand up to the military might of Iran. It's an inevitability that they'd be toppled. The government in Bahrain, which is a Sunni minority monarchy, which rules over a Shia majority.
It's propped up by the Saudi army, right, which invaded.
Yeah, they'll be toppled. And the Iranians have already been calling for the toppling of the Bahraini regime.
Well, when you look back, we look at the map of the Mideast, and you've got one of those history books, and you can see it down through the century. It has been the two great powers have been the Persian Empire and the Turkish or the Ottoman Empire. And maybe if the West is ever defeated in that region, we'll go back to those. They will be the two major powers, Turkey and Persia or Iran.
I think so. I mean, like I say, there is nothing new in history. Go into your history books. Go into your high school history books. You will see the exact same scenarios play out. This is not the first time the West has been in the Middle East, and this is not the first time superpowers have risen and fallen. And traditionally, the major powers in the region were always Turkey, Iran, and Egypt. Yeah. Those were always the three major superpowers. And Egypt's going to be relatively safe because I think Iran has no interest in invading Egypt. They have the potential to be an economically strong ally in the region. Iran is the largest military force in the region next to Turkey. And right now, Turkey and Iran, I think, view each other as allies of convenience.
But Iran is more technologically advanced than Turkey, right?
It's a bit of a toss-up because Turkey has been backed by the United States militarily for so long. In fact, actually, we've continued to back them in spite of the fact that they elected a democratically – I want to emphasize this – a democratically elected Islamist party to power, mm-hmm. which has expressed its immense desire to see Palestine – recognized and see the West Bank and Gaza liberated. So, you know, but we still back them because we have numerous military bases in there as part of our defense shield against Russia.
But they still are a pretty strong member of NATO, right?
They are because they're part of our defense shield against Russia. I mean, in the end, we can't let them go. We can't afford to lose them because if they become Russia's ally, no matter what they might do that's not in our favor, it's almost a damned if you do, damned if you don't, a catch-22. If you support them, they're going to have the strongest military in the region. It's going to be opposed to Israel. If you oppose them, they'll ally themselves with Russia, and we lose that huge chunk of our defense shield that hems in Russian power.
Well, one country we haven't talked about yet, which is going to be, in the, I think, in the news a lot the next few weeks, is Syria, where Assad has a pretty strong hold on power. But the reports are that now that he's facing armed resistance, and DEVCA, which is the Israeli newsletter, security newsletter, the DEVCA file, reported in August that NATO headquarters are considering plans or drawing up plans to arm the rebels with weapons to combat the Assad regime. And they're thinking of a strategy at NATO which is different from the strategy in Libya, where it was heavy bombardment and jihadist allies and special forces, to one where they're going to ship a lot of armaments in and infiltrate the civilian resistance group with terrorists.
Syria is a bit of a different story from Libya in the fact that Syria has a strong unity. They have a history as a nation state. Libya, not quite as much, but Syria has an ancient history as a nation state. It was one of the leaders in the Crusades. I'm sorry, in the counter Crusades, I should say, the war against the crusading kingdoms in Jerusalem and that region. Syria has a history of unity, so you can't hope to topple it by supporting these various factions, and it has to be an organized resistance. And you can't topple them by air bombardment because, let's face it, they actually have a military. You know,
Syria's pretty strong.
They do. They've been backed by Russia for years. I mean, years. And the Russians continue to have almost unquestioning support for the Syrians because we forget the Baathists, who are in power there, are a nominally socialist party, but the president himself and his family are Alawites, which are a sect of the Shia, so they also receive an immense amount of support.
Well, what can the Russians do if our intervention takes the form of this covert action and we recruit?
You know what? I actually was thinking the same thing just now. I was thinking, what are the Russians thinking now that we are just going in a domino effect, one after another, of these benefactors of Russia? They must be quite upset. I mean, the only means of combating this
and China too. China was looking to Libya as a major source of oil.
At some point, they have to feel like they're losing all of their chips.
Yeah, the Russians and the Chinese and the Iranians
they've invested heavily in these countries over the years.
Right.
And now they're just one by one being taken away.
China had 35,000 employees that were kicked out of Libya when we invaded.
I mean, I think it might not be too long before you see Russian Spetsnaz or Chinese special forces in places like Libya or Syria. I mean, I think, honestly, the Russians and the Chinese are biding their time till we bomb Iran. Because one thing we forget, and this is set up very similar to World War One, nothing's new in history, Iran has a defense treaty with Russia, which means if Iran's attacked, Russia jumps to their defense. Russia holds a defense treaty with Bolivia, Cuba, and Venezuela, and Russia also holds a defense treaty with China, who holds a defense treaty with North Korea. An attack on Iran would give them the excuse to draw their forces in.
So all the countries so far that we've invaded, and we've done so with the backing of the UN or NATO or something like that, so that it becomes this united front.
Right.
If Russia were to step in even covertly behind the scenes, it would become a world war. So I think it seems like we're picking off the weakest pegs before we take on the final assault and actually take on Russia and China head to head.
Exactly. This is,
obliterating the entire Middle East.
Do you think that the military planners in the Pentagon think that our force is so overwhelming that the Russians and China, the Russians and the Chinese will indefinitely put up with our military expansion?
There are two schools of thought. And within the military as a whole, the stuff I read in the Army Times and publications that have come out from the DOD, that Department of Defense, that say that Russia and China are this immense military threat, particularly China. We need to guard ourselves against the Chinese military. They're not to be taken lightly. I think the problem is in the civilian leadership, because when you talk to a lot of people in the civilian world and talk to people in the civilian leadership in this country, China's this backwards country, the way we think of them in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah, right.
Russia is this decadent, collapsed state since the Soviet Union fell apart. I mean, they don't have cable television, we're sure. if any of you have ever seen the movie Canadian Bacon, it's...
That's all they want. They just want TV.
Exactly. Just to, some television, some MTV, you know. So.
And blue jeans.
The Cold War is over.
We already gave up. You won. We are too busy trying to perfect universal indoor plumbing. It seems silly, but these are the concepts that most of the civilian leadership hold. So I think they genuinely believe that they could win a war against Russia and China.
Or what if the Russians and Chinese are just biding their time because they know that we're going to collapse economically?
Yes.
And they're just waiting for us to fall apart, and then they'll just go in and sweep up the pieces looking like saviors.
Yes, yes, because if I were them, I would not want to fight a war with us. I would want to wait and wait and wait.
No, no, it's like
until
we
go bankrupt.
No, it's like there's a drunk guy at the bar, and he's picking a fight with you. He's yelling at you all night long. You're like, no, just keep drinking.
Yeah,
just keep drinking.
Right.
And
that's
then you just wait till the last minute, and he gets up, he staggers, you just punch him right in the face and knock him out.
I think that's the key factor. Is that they're giving us drinks, with the debt and letting us drink ourselves in these wars. But I think
you need another billion? Here you go.
Exactly. I think a key factor in it, though, is I think invariably it is going to come to the point of a shooting war, because in the end, the Chinese, there's an old Chinese proverb that an opportunity comes once every 10,000 years. And this might be an attack on Iran might be their sole opportunity to not only knock us out as a superpower, but permanently knock us out as a superpower. The Chinese
send us back to the hole we crawled out of.
Exactly. When the Chinese wage war, and if you look at Chinese history, when they wage war, they don't wage, you know, sort of a half-hearted war, and they don't wage war frequently. When they do, they wait and wait and wait. And when they do wage war, it's absolute and total war.
And I think this is a very well taken point. And
unlike the way we do things,
I hope our audience is really starting to focus on how dangerous the situation is, how precariously close we are to ever even expanded war. And I think our corporate media has done a very poor job of making people aware of the dangerous situation we're in. I think they focus on really the phony danger of terrorism.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And you know, when we wage war, we set up places like Camp Victory, which has a Burger King. You know, I mean, like, you can't – there's just no comparison. Like, the Chinese vision of waging war is probably that they sweep in, shoot everybody, and then leave. And we like, no, we like it here. We're just going to set up a mall.
Well, and that's – I mean, you know, anybody wants to see how the Chinese wage war, look at Tibet. I mean, the Chinese – again, and this is something I think somebody once said to me that, you know, if the Chinese ever invade, we'll have, you know, every hillbilly and every, you know, guy in the ghetto will have a gun. Let me give you an idea of how the Chinese wage war, okay? When they invaded Tibet, they killed most of the population, and it was so brutal, they gave guns to children and forced them to shoot their parents. I mean, these are people
– psychological intimidation.
Exactly. Yeah. It is a – you resist us, you will die. You don't resist us, we might let you live. And now they have, Tibetan culture months and, you know, we love Tibetan culture. Most of the population of Tibet is ethnic Chinese, because then what they did is, after exterminating huge portions of the population through ethnic cleansing, what is ethnic cleansing in every sense of the word, they shipped in millions of Chinese farmers then to dilute the population, because they don't believe necessarily in racial purity the way the Japanese did during World War II, but they believe in a cultural purity. So, for example, if they were to come here, they would wipe out half of our population, ship in Chinese farmers, we'd all have to learn Chinese, and then they'd tell us that, you know, basically we were the culturally round-eyed Chinese and, you know, let's have a Western culture month.
Right.
You know, and I think that's something that most Americans aren't ready yet to wrap their mind around.
So whose interest is being served by bringing us to the brink of a global war? It's not the American people.
No, I mean, I think there's an arrogance that says one day we can defeat the Chinese. One day we will ultimately come out as the great hero, you know, kind of like a John Wayne movie where he's surrounded by the Indians.
But it's about money. It's about oil. It's about controlling oil wells, about controlling routes to oil and natural gas and the key straits like the Gulf of Aden. And it's not about what's good for the average American.
Well, that's the point, is one day it's going to result in – they envision that one day these nations will collapse, or they'll see, you know, we'll so hem them in that we will be the world's only superpower. We will control all these oil routes. And it really is a realm of fantasy, to be honest.
And you know, it's not doing a darn thing to reduce the terrible unemployment in this country, which is the key problem here. Is
it
our
very
economy
well may.
I and mean, the lack of jobs is not whether we control a given foreign country.
Well, it very well may. I mean, if war gets bad enough and they're forced to have a draft, it might not necessarily be a bad thing as far as they're concerned. Because what happens to all these young unemployed?
As far as the elite's concerned,
You know, all these young unemployed men and women coming out of college with no future. Oh, you don't have a future. There you go. Welcome to the army.
Yeah,
you can always flip burgers at Camp Victory.
Exactly. I mean, although ironically, the army doesn't actually cook its own food anymore. It's all contractors.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
5 more minutes? Okay.
So, I mean, I really think that a lot of this is a worst case scenario. It might never come to this, but you know, somebody always told me, hope for the best, plan for the worst. You know, mm-hmm. we can bury our heads in the sand and say, you know, China's never going to be a threat. Russia will never be a threat. Iran is just full of all filibustering. And who knows? I mean, not filibustering, full of bluster. And who knows? Iran may be full of bluster. But I rather say that we're going to come to blows with them and have the American people mentally prepare themselves for that vote in peace candidates rather than bury our heads in the sand and just pray to God that they're full of themselves or pray to God that Israel won't actually attack Iran.
Right.
We just have a few minutes left. If you'd like to weigh in on any of these foreign policy military questions we've been talking about, please give us a call at 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756. Or drop us an email at ken@mdrtalk.org. And you're listening to In Context on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut. And we're with you at the first Sunday at 10 p.m. at Dave Schwartz's show. And we're going to be on the air on the second and fourth Mondays of every month at from noon until 1 for 1 hour. And we'll be taking your calls in all our shows.
Quickly, what do you make of the headline of Iran moving their nuclear technology underground? Do you think that that's, in a sense, admitting that they are enriching it, or they're just reacting to all of the bluster and threats, especially with the example that's been made of Libya and Iraq and all these countries that don't just get in line, as we say?
I think it's a bit of both, because one thing to remember is that before we invaded Iraq in 2003, Saddam said, oh, you know, let the IAEA come in and do their job. And, you know, I swear to God, we have no nukes. And, you know, whereas Iran, by doing this, is in a way hinting to the West, hey, you know, we might not.
But I'm not going to show you.
Yeah. Do you want to find out? And by moving their facilities underground, maybe they'd never exist. But the idea is it puts us on high alert.
It has a hand that hasn't been shown, and there's more value in a secret than there is in an open truth. But what about the fact that Iran even offered to have France enrich it for them so that it could be guaranteed not to be weapons grade? And the U.S. Said no to that because they won't accept any nuclear power in Iran.
It's all about getting the moral high ground. I mean, if feasibly right now, Iran has the capability of not only going to blows with Israel, but better than even chance of defeating Israel. However, if they went to war now, if they enriched uranium on their own right away, they would lose that moral high ground. So now they can say feasibly, oh, well, you know, we went to France, but the Americans wouldn't let us, so we had to enrich it on our own. And what do you know? We decided to make bombs.
Well, it's really, again...
Well, I mean, we should have taken that deal then, no?
Well, they knew we never would.
Why didn't we, though?
Well, we should have.
Because it's ridiculous.
We do not want peace with Iran. Right?
I know the answer.
All right. Obviously, we want the oil. And didn't the Iranian government at some point in recent years make overtures to the U.S. government to try to have friendlier relations, and we rebuffed them?
All through the 90s, under President Khatami, who was the previous to the current president, Ahmadinejad, President Khatami actually made various overtures to the West. In fact, in 2001, Iran did not like the Taliban by any stretch of the imagination. In 2001, Iran provided intelligence to U.S. armed forces and U.S. special forces operating in Afghanistan. They did the same thing when we invaded Iraq in 2003. And Iran said, you know, we're here. We want to, you know, we want to be friends with the West. We want to westernize. You know, it's still going to be an Islamic Republic. We don't want naked women on our billboards, but we want to westernize. And, you know, the West, as particularly the U.S., pretty much said, you know, you're on your own. Go to hell. And so as a result, the great leader, as he's known, the Ayatollah, the Grand Ayatollah of Iran, who selects the candidates that run in the election, allowed only hardliners after that. And the people after that had lost patience. Khatami lost all influence. And they elected people like Ahmadinejad and all hardliners because of that.
And then you look at the map, Iran should be our ally. And it could have, certainly they had a democratic government before we overthrew it in 1953. They have a natural animosity to Russia. Russia wants to move south and into the Iranian territory. They're repelled by Russia's atheist tradition under communism. They should be our ally.
Well, I mean, you know, it's kind of like how we alienated Russia after, you know, after the collapse of the Soviet Union.
Well, thanks very much for joining us. You're listening to In Context. This is Ken McDermott Rowe. I'm here with my fellow host, Gus Cantavero. We've been speaking also in tonight's show with our military affairs commentator, Marchand McDermott Rowe. And we'll be here again. Our next show will be on September the 12th. That's Monday from noon to 1 p.m. It'll be our first show under the new schedule. We hope you can join us then.
That's the second and fourth Monday of the month from noon to 1 p.m.
And we'll be again here with Dave on Sunday nights. And we'll bring you again another installment of the War Report.
Have a good night.
Take care, everybody.
Have a good night, and God bless the Republic.
Good night.
Up where we live, we've got everything. We've got the cuckoo and a nightingale. We've got a